Hello, welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ben, bringing you this week's Sports Illustrated magazine. This week, we're going to be starting the December issue of Sports Illustrated, starting with the cover article, Kicking It Up a Notch by Connor Orr, dealing with NFL special teams. We'll be following that with an article on women's hockey, and then an article on men's golf. All that and more. Thanks again for joining. Let's get started. We'll get things started with the cover article of this issue, Kicking It Up a Notch, by Connor Orr. The third phase of the game had been the NFL's forgotten frontier. But those at the forefront of a special teams revolution this season are finding an edge in unexpected ways. Back in March, Florida State held its pro day on campus in Tallahassee. The main attractions for most talent evaluators were cornerback Ezra Thomas, who would be drafted in the third round by the Jets, and defensive tackle Joshua Farmer, a future Patriots fourth rounder. But among the 18 players who worked out that day, the one who may end up having the biggest impact on the 2025 NFL season is kicker Ryan Fitzgerald. And not because, as coverage of the event noted, he nailed a 68-yard field goal in front of scouts. After most attendees had left, Fitzgerald had an hour-long semi-private meeting with a few curious NFL teams' reps. Dan Orner, a private kicking coach who had been working with Fitzgerald for a few years, says scouts from the Browns and Giants asked his pupil to go through an additional battery of workouts that showcased what Orner called the kicker's bag of tricks. For a year, Fitzgerald and Orner had been practicing ways to knuckleball a kickoff with just this moment in mind. The importance of that conversation would become clear less than 2 weeks later, when NFL owners voted at their annual meeting on April 1st to tweak the touchback rule. Offenses would now get the ball at the 35-yard line rather than the 30. You may have missed the change at the time since everyone was screaming about the legality of the Eagles' tush push, which was hotly debated at the meetings. Over the last five seasons, drives that began at the 30-yard line scored a touchdown or field goal at a rate of 37.4%. Drives that began at the 35-yard line scored at 44.8%. A touchback that put the ball on the 32 or 33 might still have made kicking the ball out of the end zone a smart play. But inside the NFL analytics community, the consensus is that the 5-yard difference equated to a statistically significant addition of expected points. Suddenly, teams were far more wary of handing an opponent a touchback, and some of them became extremely interested in alternative kickoffs that would hit the ground in the landing zone and allow the coverage team to leave its stationary position. A ball that bounced unpredictably and was difficult to field would be a significant bonus. With all this in mind, those curious souls in Tallahassee watched as Fitzgerald showed how he can keep his leg swing consistent, but based on the tilt of the ball, the placement of the tee, or the strike point, make the ball behave in strange ways. For one of his knuckle kicks, Fitzgerald, a right-footed kicker, tees the ball up like a left-footed kicker would, making it look a bit curved, like an end parentheses. The higher strike point toward the ankle, and the higher the strike point of the football, the more the ball dances in the air. The scouts asked if Fitzgerald could disguise his intentions, making a knuckleball windup and a traditional windup look identical. He could. They asked if he could keep the knuckleball action consistent from their right to the left. He could. They basically said, "Please don't show this to anyone else," Orner says. And that's when I said to Ryan, "Congratulations, you made the NFL." Fitzgerald ended up signing with the Panthers as an undrafted free agent. The obscurity of his unique kicks and those of another of Orner's clients, the Rams' Joshua Cardi, didn't last long. Through the first 7 weeks of the season, Los Angeles, 26.1-yard line, and Carolina, 26.2-yard line, ranked second and third in average opponent starting field position after kickoffs. The last place team in the stat, the Jets, surrendered more than 8 additional yards per drive start, resulting in a nearly 15% improvement in opponents' scoring chance. The sudden weaponization of the kickoff has been just one aspect of a special team revolution this season. Through week 7, there were 17 blocked field goals and punts, with 3 of them directly deciding the outcome of the game in the final seconds. More 50-plus yard field goals were being attempted per game than at any time in NFL history. More field goals of any distance were being made than ever. the number of kick returns per game quadrupled from 2024. Seemingly overnight, an aspect of football once seen as an excellent opportunity for spectator bathroom breaks was sparking some hard questions. Should practice time be reallocated for special teams? How should kickers, punters, and returners be valued? What really makes a good special team coordinator? Should more starters be playing special teams? And yes, should parents be buying their grade school kickers tile brush power tool attachments so they can doctor their kicking balls like the professionals? Too late, it's already happening. John Bones Fassel of the Titans, one of the league's most experienced special team coordinators, says that, in the best possible way, his reaction had been, "What is going on?" He and many other coaches say this season has piqued new levels of intellectual curiosity and creativity around the kicking game. Special teams are the wild, wild west, Fassel says. You just don't know what's going to happen. In the spring of 2024, three men walked onto a vacant practice field in Houston, determined to figure out what the future might look like. Frank Ross, the Texans special teams coordinator, is one of the league's most successful and the winner of the final two Rick Goslin special team rankings. The legendary Dallas sports writer, who retired the list after the 2023 season, created a 22-point grading rubric for kicking game units that became an industry standard for rating special teams. Ross, assistant special team coordinator Will Burnham, and hybrid assistant Sean Baker stood roughly 7 yards apart from one another and started experimenting with the bones of what a new dynamic kickoff might look like if it ever came to the NFL. There was nothing to work off of, save the tape from the XFL, the alternative league, which featured a similar kickoff. They started working through their own theories, playing the roles of kickoff blockers or coverage men. Ross would ask Burnham if, in a certain situation, he could track him down at a certain angle. To the uninitiated, it may have looked a bit like synchronized swimming practice on dry land. Ross says it was a bunch of 5'10 white guys and describes the movements on the field that day as not explosive. That day, Ross created what he calls his feedback loop, a hard file of running dialogue with his players that is still in use. Because everything was created from scratch, everything was tailored to the abilities of the players at his disposal. Was any of this comfortable for them? Were the movements coaches were asking them to make feasible? It wasn't necessarily about X's and O's, Ross says. What do you want your feet to look like? How do you envision yourself? This sounds silly, but do you want your butt in or out to the sideline? Anytime there's a change, then, it's a race to who can figure it out, Burnham says. So I'd say the first feeling was excitement because you really are throwing out a lot of years of football. This moment reflected the true malleability of special teams from 2024 to present day. There are raging debates over the use of larger players, tight ends, linebackers, fullbacks, and defensive ends, on kickoff returns, and how overall roster construction can favor or adversely impact kickoff unit personnel. Kickoff returns will evolve constantly over the next few years, coaches predict. The evolution extends beyond kickoffs. Take the boom in longer field goals. Kicking experts like Orner says that outside of the fact that teams are now allowed to prepare K-balls throughout the week to make them more kicker-friendly instead of only on game day, the biggest change in the kicking game is that kickers are now plucked from a much more athletic pool and have become less dependent on wedge-style kicking. This method, which uses the inside of the foot, was accurate, but sacrificed power. Now, according to Orner, young kickers are more likely to also be track athletes or stars in other sports. Kicks are recorded with the precision of Tiger Woods' backswing and examined from the smallest of adjustments. Middle schoolers have personal kicking coaches. Orner also believes that college football's mass import of kickers and punters from Australia raised the bar for American kickers, who had to compete with far more natural and experimental kickers. In the first 7 weeks of this season, teams attempted 119 field goals of 50 yards or more. That number has been climbing in recent years. As recently as 2020, there were only 168 attempted all season. The very real possibility that someone will soon make a 70-yard field goal, the likes of which Jaguars kicker Cam Little hit in the preseason, would then seem to be the culmination of these parallel transformations. But Ross wonders if we're missing something. "I'll ask you a question," he says over the phone just a few days before the Texans took on the Seahawks in Week 7. "Who is a better shooter, Ray Allen or Steph Curry?" He continues, "There's an argument for both. I probably would say Steph, but Ray Allen was at one point the all-time leading three-point shooter, right? Well, Steph necessarily isn't a better shooter, but he changed the game because he was more confident to shoot from different spots further away. So is Cowboys kicker Brandon Aubrey a better kicker than former Patriots kicker, five-time NFL scoring leader, and four-time Pro Bowler Steven Goskowski? Or is Brandon Aubrey just shooting from different spots?" Another point of division? Kick blocks. Through Week 7, the league was on pace for 30 field goal blocks. There were 18 total last year. Some NFL coordinators blame the surge on a hangover from the preseason, where teams don't typically rush kickers aggressively and almost never rush them live in practice. Like missed tackle numbers that tend to even out once players acclimate to the physicality, blockers will be less likely to get mauled by more skilled defensive players. However, others concede that there is a greater focus on the science behind kick blocking, just as there is on kicking itself. Fassel and the Titans had one of the most visually satisfying extra point blocks of all time in Week 2 against the Rams, when Arden Key arrived in front of kicker Cardi Foley in rejection mode, arms rising above his head in the shape of a diamond and swatting the ball half a field goal away. You could hear the ricochet off his elbow and face mask, and it shot like 40 yards backwards, Fassel says. Yeah, that was cool. In Week 3, the Eagles blocked Cardi on two consecutive field goal attempts utilizing a rush scheme that bludgeoned one of the Rams' protectors in the outer C-gap and performed what coaches call a corkscrew action to penetrate the vacant space. The attack was so precise that the Rams tried to counter it. It didn't work by replacing one of its blockers from one kick to the next. Clearly, Philadelphia knew the pressure point it was trying to expose. It could be that all of this, knuckleball kicks, longer field goals, and increased number of blocks, are at least somewhat connected. Mike Westhoff, one of the NFL's most recognizable special teams coaches, who retired after a 33-year career last year, feels that kickers attempting 70-yard field goals are unconsciously lowering the angle of the ball, a necessity to drive it longer distances, thus making it easier to block. And the inability to protect kickers may be a kind of breaking point of roster construction. Reserve offensive linemen, backup tight ends, and defensive players, some of whom make up the protection units of field goals and point after touchdowns, are worse and less experienced as blockers than ever before. This was an inefficiency ripe for taking advantage of, especially since, as special teams coordinators can universally attest, none of them were given an increase in practice time during the week to solve all these issues. Commissioner Roger Goodell, when asked about the new kickoff during the league's international series, admitted there was an intentionality behind bringing special teams to the forefront. Though fixing one problem could have another effect, regardless, everyone touching the sport feels it. Longtime kick returners like Jamal Agnew of the Falcons says he feels relieved, no longer relegated to eternally watching touchback kicks fly over his head. "I always want to take it out on every kick," he says. Kickers are emboldened, with some in their circles wondering if dominating field positions means bigger paydays. Most kickers in the NFL make less than $4 million per season. Coaches, Ross says, have more access to varsity players than ever before. Ross also says something one can imagine many special teams coaches are thinking but aren't quite ready to say out loud. They have long been ignored for bigger opportunities. The Ravens' John Harbaugh is the only current NFL coach with a majority special teams background, and even he had to spend a year as a defensive position coach before getting hired by Baltimore. And no special team coordinator has ever won the Assistant Coach of the Year award. But now, special team specialists are seeing a public legitimization of private mastery. Special teams is not just a slack hire anymore, Ross says. It's a factor. It matters, and I think it's going to continue to shape the game. As Orner, the private kicking coach, was getting off the phone, the car door shut, and he began walking toward the practice field for a lesson with a youth client currently in ninth grade, one of hundreds of clients in high school or college. In his spare time, Orner has been scouring Instagram pages of amateur kickers, some without any traceable sports background, making trick shot kicking videos and high wire soccer free kicks. He says he learns as much from younger kids and these videos as he does from professionals. This is going to be the future, an opinion that Orner shares with many special team coaches who believe that knuckle kicks are just the beginning. I watch that stuff and people would think I'm crazy, he says. But I'm not crazy when two of my guys, Fitzgerald and Cardi, are leading the league in field position percentage. Orner says that Fitzgerald, for instance, has yet to debut an NFL game a version of his knuckleball kick that does not require any steps to lead in. He imagines that by week 13 or 14, Fitzgerald will be able to debut the real cool ones. When pressed for details, he says Fitzgerald and Cardi can kick balls that have a helicopter-style spin, balls that, from their right foot, can mimic the banana-like wobble of a left-footed punt, and with less consistency, something that he refers to as the Texas tornado. It spins like a tornado when it hits the ground, and it will run back 15 yards, he says. Just like Roy McRoy's pitching wedge. We've been working on this for about 3 or 4 years, and we finally got some distance to it. So we'll see. With this in mind, a recent Giants practice took on an entirely different vibe. Silence across a chilly, sun-splashed field in East Rutherford, New Jersey, was broken by a loud thwomp of a football barreling end over end through a jugs machine toward a return man, Gunnar Ozalski, who was simulating his task for the weekend ahead. As the wind picked up and the angle of the machine was altered, some of the balls drifted left or right. One of them died at his feet and bounced off his shin. The Giants have two players, punter Jamie Gillen, a Scottish-born rugby player, and kicker Jude McTamey, an Irish-born former Gaelic football player who can hit knuckleball kickoffs in practice. A third, long snapper Casey Kreider, is spotted sometimes attempting knuckleball kickoffs, and his special teams coordinator, Michael Gobriel, who will look over and say, "What are you doing, dude?" Gobriel, who coaches one of the best kickoff coverage units in the NFL, says that he could probably hit a knuckleball too, just not on purpose or with any idea of where it might land. His joke broke the seriousness of what was otherwise a display of how deeply he cares about his life's vocation. He wasn't buying the idea that his day-to-day experience amid this special teams coup was necessarily different for him because the level of importance of special teams has always been held with the utmost regard. He adds, "It's why I do what I do." Still, he admits that now everyone is watching the opening kickoff. Everyone is watching the return. Everyone is watching every field goal and punt and extra point. It matters in a very specific sense as it pertains to expected points and field position and the little moments that now define wins and losses like never before. But it also matters because something, a way of life, out there on that sunny practice field and thousands everywhere just like it, was about to die. To have it back, he says, just minutes before donning a royal blue jacket and lining up his punt unit, is exceptional. The next article I'll be reading is No Longer on Thin Ice. Several women's hockey leagues have launched and failed, but the PWHL looks poised to thrive, by Kristen Nelson. When Kelly Panik got a call in September 2023 to join PWHL Minnesota, everything was finally falling into place. The launch of the Professional Women's Hockey League had been announced just a few days earlier, and the first puck was set to drop in 4 months. There were 6 franchises: Minnesota, Boston, Montreal, New York, Ottawa, and Toronto. But no team nicknames. No other players had signed on yet. Minnesota didn't even have a coach. But Panic did not hesitate to become the first player to officially ink a contract with the league. This is what she and hundreds of other women's hockey players had been working toward for years. It felt like a no-brainer, Panic says. Minnesota's been a huge part of my life. It's where I'm from. It's where I've grown up. Then, to continue my professional career in Minnesota, that's something I never was able to dream of. When Panic graduated from the University of Minnesota in 2019, becoming a pro wasn't a given. At the time, the Canadian Women's Hockey League, CWHL, had just folded. There was the National Women's Hockey League, NWHL, but more than 200 players were boycotting it because they weren't earning livable wages. Instead, players created the Professional Women's Hockey Players Association, PWHPA, which played exhibition games to garner support for establishing a united and sustainable North American league. After 4 years of sacrificing their pro careers, there was finally a league that checked all the boxes for Panic and her peers, thanks to a hefty financial commitment from Dodgers owner Mark Walter, the Council of Billie Jean King, and an 8-year collective bargaining agreement that players worked on. It wasn't easy to get the league off the ground in a matter of months. But now heading into its third season, with team names given to those original six franchises, sellout crowds showing up across the U.S. and Canada, and expansion teams set to join in Seattle and Vancouver, the PWHL has swiftly established that there is an appetite for professional women's hockey. We tend to do things quickly around here, says Jaina Hefford, the PWHL's executive vice president of hockey operations. But what is being accomplished at a rapid pace is something many had spent years or even decades preparing for. Hefford was one of the lucky ones. During her playing days in the mid-1990s and 2000s, she didn't have to have a day job. She coached at camps, did some speaking events, and had a few endorsements. She was one of the few true professionals in the sport. The majority of my teammates were teachers or lawyers or whatever else during the day, Hefford says. The first league to actually pay its players salaries was the second iteration of the NWHL. When it was founded in 2015, players were paid from $10,000 to $26,000 a season. But that didn't last long, with player wages getting cut up to 50% in the league's second year. After the CWHL shuttered, the NWHL was the only pro option left on the continent. The game's top players decided there was too much bad blood to continue, with mistrust around everything from laughable salaries to having to pay for their own travel to facilities that didn't have adequate facilities. Players didn't always have access to a locker room or bathrooms during practice, and thus had to relieve themselves in a trash can. You're playing in a glorified beer league, U.S. Olympian Hillary Knight said in 2020. Hefford, who was interim commissioner of the CWHL in its final season, was asked to join the PWHPA as an operations consultant. Players initially hoped their boycott of the NWHL would last just a year. But it wasn't until the PWHPA joined forces with Walter and King in 2022 and officially unionized in 2023 that they were finally able to make meaningful progress. We committed all along that this was going to be a player-first league, Hefford says. That collaboration between the players' union and the league is unlike any other league. A 62-page CBA was signed in July 2023, setting minimum salaries at $35,000 and requiring teams to pay at least six players $80,000 for the first season. And then things moved quickly. The league was officially announced that August, with players signing contracts in September. Training camp started in November, and the first puck dropped on New Year's Day 24. On day one, there were 2,537 fans watching at a sold-out Metomi Athletic Century for Toronto versus New York, with 2.9 million viewers watched on TV in Canada alone. On day two, Ottawa set a pro women's hockey attendance record of 8,318 at TD Place. On day six, Minnesota set a new one with 13,316 at Xcel Energy Center. They took things on the road with neutral site games in Pittsburgh and Detroit. where another attendance record was set. Year two was much of the same, as teams like Montreal and Toronto moved to larger venues, and the league had 9 neutral site games to reach new fans. This past offseason, Emily Clark signed a record-setting contract with the Ottawa Charge, joining 8 other players to reportedly be making 6 figures. PWHL Executive Vice President of Business Operations Amy Shear told the Associated Press earlier this year that the league sponsorships had grown by 50% and merchandise sales had doubled. This wasn't just a novelty, and it certainly didn't hurt that the league hit the ice smack dab in the middle of the women's sports movement, with more eyes on the WNBA and NWSL than ever before. "I think you have to pay attention to it," Panic says. "I think it's really exciting to add to it with the PWHL, right? What's really cool is that those leagues are 10, 20 years ahead of us, and we're still keeping pace with some of the norms in the workplace and professionalism in women's sports. To be able to kind of see the parallels and see the differences, and also see where, okay, that's where they got in 10, 20 years. Where can we get in 10 or 20 years?" Already in the first phase of expansion, the PWHL is cruising past its own expectations. Seattle and Vancouver, both of which will carry the tradition of not having team names in their first seasons, are adding a new time zone to the league. There is talk of adding more franchises in the near future, though Hefford says the league first wants to see how the new additions fare in the first half of this season. It's not lost on Hefford how different this is from not just her playing days, when it was mostly friends and family in the stands and practices were held at 9 p.m. after work, but also from her initial days as an executive. "When I was with the CWHL, we had 5 people working for the league, and that was an international league that had teams in Canada, the U.S., and China at the time," Hefford says. "You look at where we are, and it's just amazing. You really understand the importance of the investment that needs to be made to get off the ground. The players have a CBA, they have some certainty, they understand what they will get in return, and they understand what they need to provide. As a league, just the growth of having a marketing department, having an officiating department, having groups of people that every day focus on growing the league, it's just really exciting time. We know there's so much growth ahead, and we're going to look different in a couple years than we do right now." Not every team has been an instant success, though. Playing in Bridgeport, Connecticut, Elmont, New York, and Newark, the New York franchise has twice finished at the bottom of the attendance standings. New York was always going to be a tough sports market to break into, Hefford admits. There were 13 major pro teams in the metropolitan area before the Sirens came to town. Building a successful new franchise takes time, with grassroots efforts at local kids' camps and finding other ways to reach fans who don't automatically gravitate towards hockey like they do in Canadian markets. New York has obviously struggled, but I see that as more of an opportunity rather than a setback, says Casey O'Brien, who was drafted 3rd out of Wisconsin by the Sirens in June. She grew up in New York City and remembers going to Liberty games at Madison Square Garden when the team averaged 10,000 fans. The center is hoping her new team can find a way to reach that level. "We can definitely follow in their footsteps." As the league grows, Hefford says there is still a focus on making sure original franchises like the Sirens improve their vitality. "Our job is to maintain the competitive balance," Hefford says. "I think it's one of our greatest strengths. To keep the on-ice product entertaining, the PWHL has deviated from what women's hockey has looked like in the past. The league allows a hybrid body check, which is more physical than what fans might be used to seeing at the collegiate level. It has also implemented the jailbreak rule, which allows a player to be freed from the penalty box when their team scores shorthanded. As the league grows, expansion has added 46 roster spots and 30 more games. Hefford says it's going to be hard to predict what happens in year 3. But Panic, whose Minnesota Frost won the first two PWHL titles, has big expectations for this season, which begins November 21st. So what can fans look for? More chaos, Panic says. I feel like our league just has some chaotic moments in games, which is so fun. I also feel like there'll be some rivalries maybe this year that start to develop with more teams. Chaos, after all, is how the PWHL started, and it seems to be working so far. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ben. Thanks again for listening to this week's Sports Illustrated. The next article I'll be reading is Global Golf. A fledgling seniors competition could capitalize on fans' Ryder Cup hangovers, by Jeff Ritter. Golf fans still buzzing about, or perhaps sobering up from, the recent Ryder Cup at Bethpage Black can take heart. There's yet another innovative international match play golf competition on tap before the year's end, the World Champions Cup. The second iteration of the event, which will be held from December 4th to 7th in Clearwater, Florida, and air on ESPN and ABC, will feature players from golf's 50 and over set. The field includes several Hall of Famers and major winners, including Justin Leonard, who helped usher in an era of the overly boisterous celebration when he clinched the 1999 Ryder Cup for the U.S. with a 45-foot putt that led to bedlam on the green and in the stands. Unlike the Ryder Cup setup with the U.S. and Europe going head-to-head, the World Champions Cup features three teams, the U.S., Europe, and the rest of the world, playing simultaneously. Also, each team's captain will tee up and earn points alongside their squads. Here's how it works. 2 days of team sessions will include a little-used but delightfully named format called Scottish Sixums, where players will compete in two-man teams, with each golfer teeing off and then selecting one ball to play as alternate shots for the rest of the hole. There will also be sessions of six ball, in which each member of a two-man team plays his own ball from start to finish. The final day features a series of traditional singles matches, played in threesomes. "It gives us a chance to be a team again," says U.S. captain Jim Furyk. "And for snowbirds, it's a chance to show those New York fans how it's done." The next article I'll be reading is Class Act, photography by Lane Stewart. Being photographed for Sports Illustrated's NBA preview issue in 1981 took the Los Angeles Lakers 35 minutes. Setting up the shot, on the other hand, took Lane Stewart the better part of a week. The theme of the story was back to school, so it made sense to picture the six players and coach Paul Westhead in a vintage classroom. The problem was, there wasn't a school near the team's facility. So Stewart built one from scratch in a hotel conference room, a process that took 6 days. Being near Hollywood, he was able to rent things like portraits of presidents, a radiator, and a light switch. But things like the desks, door, and globe took a little more time to source. Then there was the matter of the floor, walls, and blackboards, all of which Stewart constructed. After painting the walls a dingy white and scattering some chalk dust, he was just about ready. The final touches were the apples, which Stewart waited to purchase until the morning of the shoot, so they'd remain, as he said, the brightest red apples I could find. The next article I'll be reading is Golden Touch. In a different era, the Warriors had an owner of a very different stripe, by L. John Worthy. Perched regally in the Mission Bay district of San Francisco, the Chase Center is, yes, the home of the NBA's Warriors and the WNBA Valkyries, but it doubles as a monument to today's sports industrial complex. Part of a waterfront development district, the area sits nestled among Uber's headquarters, coffee shops that sell cappuccinos by the tankard, and Oracle Park, home of the San Francisco Giants, which, by comparison, seems downright old-timey. Sponsored by one of the world's largest banks and opened in 2019, the Chase Center is a basketball pleasure dome featuring 2 million per season bunker suites replete with wine cellars. For the common fans, there's local fare like Bake Sale Betty's fried chicken sandwiches and pork al pastor tacos from Backyard Burritos for sale on the concourse. Parking is sparse, but there's a bicycle valet, this being San Francisco and all. Stand on the plaza and you'll enjoy a view of Northern California terrain. Look eastward, and almost an act of trolling, you'll see Oakland, the team's previous home. The building nicknamed the House That Steph Built, but its main attraction, Steph Curry, is less a sports star than a global celebrity. He also has a reported nine-figure net worth, boosted by his $60 million annual paying salary. Golden State has won four NBA titles in the last decade, though only one has come during the team's six seasons at the Chase Center. This is a franchise that last sold for $450 million. That was in 2010. It is now valued at around $9 billion. No one would have loved this transformation more than the Warriors' first Bay Area owner, Franklin Muley. So many of his ideas and ideals, considered fanciful at the time, have come to fruition. A team not merely representing a city, but standing as a civic treasure, creating jobs, leaking revenue like beads of sweat. Broadcast technology that enables the Warriors to attract fans well beyond the Golden State, never mind the Bay Area. An authoritative but compassionate coach, all at a time when sports have grown into their own financial sector, no longer a diversion so trivial that its section of the San Francisco Chronicle needs its own unserious color. Muley would take in the entire tabloid and not merely smile approvingly, but then also laugh his familiar laugh. But that's all largely speculative, because it's preposterous Muley could actually be found. Here was an owner who now seems as much a relic as the 6'8 center or NBA players working in sporting goods stores in the offseason to supplement their income. Today, slick, credentialed hedge fund titans or venture capitalists, to wit, the Warriors' Joe Lacob owns teams and now needs help from private equity to make the purchase. In the 60s, 70s, and up through the mid-80s, the Warriors were owned by a man who was the son of a San Jose gardener, often slept on a houseboat, and cared as much about good vibes as balance sheets, running the team not as a CFO, but as a fan. Inasmuch as a measure of celebrity came with owning the local sports team, none of it went to Muley's head. Perhaps that's because that head was usually shrouded in a Sherlock Holmes-esque deerstalker cap. His headwear invariably set off his substantial beard and the Hawaiian shirt he favored, unbuttoned to the point that a carpet of chest hair poked out. His favorite mode of transportation was a motorcycle, though he often forgot where he'd parked it, leaving him to return to restaurants days later to retrieve it. As he once put it to the Chronicle, "I had too many motorcycles and too short a memory." Muley had great presence, but also great absence, a man known for his sporadic disappearances. When the urge struck or his stress levels rose, he would hide out at home, or bike to Mexico, or hike Yosemite. For days, even calls from his loyal assistants would go unanswered. When Sports Illustrated writer Frank DeFord once asked Muley where he would go during his walkabouts, the owner was coy. "I'm very judicious about my hiding. I'll hide somewhere where I also have some business to take care of. I'm not going all the way to Chicago just to hide." But then, when pressed, he gave a specific example of a choice hiding spot. "Well, all right, I'll tell you one place, because I haven't gone there recently. This place I used to go to a lot was down in Santa Cruz. I'd visit some Italian fishermen up there, the Carniglia boys, and work with them. I'd put on the outfits, the rubber boots and all. It was very unlikely that anyone would think of looking for Franklin, working with the Carnglia boys. Leave it to Oakland Raiders owner, L. Davis. He of the black leather jackets, the slick hair, the enemies list, to traffic in grievances, and offer the just win, baby, vocabulary of war. Leave it to the Oakland A's owner, Charlie Finley, to berate his employees, throw around nickels as if they were manhole covers, and threaten to move the team. Their fellow Bay Area sports owner would be seeking refuge with the Carnglia boys, rubber boots and all. Was Muley known to wear a fake mustache and sideburns for kicks? Was he on a first-name basis with the staff of every Italian restaurant in North Beach? Did Muley, more generally, cut a widely idiosyncratic profile? Yes. Yes, he did. Even his current Wikipedia bio describes him thusly. An eccentric personality, Muley in shrewd, formal attire, and conservative grooming in favor for a casual wardrobe, and his ever-present full beard and deerstalker. But that undersells his influence. Muley may have been one of the more offbeat owners in pro sports, which, of course, is saying something. But, burnished by time, he also takes his rightful place as one of the most important. By his own admission, Muley was kissed by the sports gods. He stopped growing well south of 6 feet. He often battled his weight. He struggled to throw a tight spiral, but his timing was exquisite. Muley was born in San Jose in 1920, the son of Italian immigrants. His father, Giacomo, eventually ran a sprawling nursery. As a kid, Muley would make the 50-mile jaunt north from South Bay to San Francisco. There awaited a wonderland of bridges, fog, and tall buildings that seemed to literally scrape the sky. So exotic, Muley called it the city, a shorthand he would later use to market his team. After attending the University of Oregon and serving in the Navy during World War II, he got a job working in the ad department for San Francisco's Burgermeister Brewery. There, he helped arrange the marriage between beer and sports. "Of course, it was luck," he told Sports Illustrated. "Everyone credited me for my clairvoyance at first. I didn't know anything." Luck is hardly a strong enough term for what came next. Muley happened upon a newspaper item about the San Francisco 49ers possibly being up for sale. As it turned out, the account was erroneous. But Muley followed up and landed a meeting with the team's owner, Tony Morabito. They discussed Burgermeister sponsoring 49ers games on the fast-growing new medium of television. Muley seized on the idea to produce games himself starting in 1954. He left the brewery, started a production company, got in good with the team, and, a few years later, the 49ers offered him a 10% share in the franchise for $60,000. In 1962, Muley led an investor group that rustled up $850,000 to move the Philadelphia Warriors to San Francisco. Using his equity in the 49ers as collateral, he then obtained a controlling interest in the team a year later. After the baseball Giants left New York and headed to San Francisco in 1958, Muley began producing their games. He'd travel with the team, go drinking with the managers, coaches, and broadcasters, hold down the piano bar, and then suddenly disappear. Chubb Feeney, a Giants executive who would later become National League president, nicknamed Muley the Phantom. Muley shrugged. "It's just too much trouble," he once said, "to say goodnight." After one of the Giants' owners, Joan Payson, opposed the team's relocation, Muley was happy to buy her shares and invest in baseball as well. Oh, and at the 1960 Winter Olympics in Squaw Valley, Muley produced the English-language radio broadcast. As DeFord put it, "Suddenly this wacky florist from San Jose was the only guy in San Francisco who owned part of every team in town. and also had a virtual monopoly on all the sports TV and radio production that came out of the Bay Area. Still, the Warriors were his true love. Though Wilt Chamberlain, then the preeminent basketball player on the planet, was on the team, the Warriors struggled to draw fans and hemorrhaged money. Muley doubled and tripled and quadrupled down routinely, buying out fellow investors who couldn't stomach the losses. Muley was a firm believer in the gospel of hoops. He could frequently be seen taking shots at a basket he had installed outside the Warriors' modest offices. He believed that basketball translated beautifully to television. He also understood the power, both financial and communal, of the sports venue. Though he had a hard time finding a decent home for his franchise in San Francisco. In the 60s, the Warriors toggled between the Dowdy Civic Auditorium and the Cow Palace, a glorified barn in Daly City, more cow than palace, where, as the name implies, the stench of livestock hung thick in the air. For 5 seasons, the Warriors wore jerseys embroidered with the words, "The City," a nod to Muley's boyhood awe of San Francisco. But without a proper venue, the Warriors filled dates in such places as Bakersfield, Fresno, Las Vegas, Oakland, Richmond, Sacramento, San Diego, and San Jose. In January 1965, Muley traded Wilt back to Philadelphia's new team, the 76ers, reasoning that San Francisco was an underdog town, and a Leviathan like Chamberlain didn't fit the culture. Instead, he drafted slick-shooting Rick Barry. During the 1966-67 season, the Warriors lost money, but won games, advancing to the NBA Finals before losing to Chamberlain and the Sixers. They then lost Barry, who intentionally sat out the next season to exhaust his contract, and then jumped to the ABA's Oakland Oaks. The more Muley was advised to sell the team and let it leave town, the more committed he became to make pro basketball work in the Bay Area. Murray Olderman of San Francisco's Examiner once wrote, "It would be easy to toss off Franklin, because of his dress and casual lifestyle, as a buffoon. He is a smart guy who hung on in professional basketball because he is convinced that it, like everything else he has touched in his life, will ultimately make him a bundle." But Muley had social as well as financial goals in the days when the NBA was widely considered too black. He encouraged the front office to sign black players. 10 of the 12 on the Golden State's 1975 title team were black. So was the coach, L. Addles, a former Warriors player who was one of the first black full-time coaches in professional basketball. In 1969, at the owner's behest, the Warriors drafted a woman, Denise Long. It was a publicity stunt. It was also against NBA rules. But Muley had ambitions of creating a women's professional basketball league. Former Warriors center George Johnson put it this way: "When you see Franklin and have not met him, you say, he's sort of strange. But once you get to know him, you change your mind." In 1971, Muley made Oakland the team's primary home, changing the name to the Golden State Warriors, a hedge if he had to continue staging games in other California markets like San Diego and San Jose. The following season, he re-signed Barry. During the 1974-75 season, the Warriors drew modestly 8,800 a night on average in a building that held 13,000. But won liberally. With Barry averaging more than 30 points a game, the Warriors got better with each round of the playoffs and suddenly became NBA champions. When his team swept the Washington Bullets in 4 games and claimed the trophy, Muley described the experience as a delightful haze of animation. Even the triumphant postseason offered both a glimpse of Muley's venue challenges and a bit of foreshadowing. The Warriors were such underdogs that season that the Oakland Coliseum had booked the Ice Follies for mid-May. When the Warriors reached the finals, they had to move their games to that point, the most critical games in franchise history, back across the bay to the Cal Palace. When the Warriors returned from Washington after the final sweep, engine troubles forced the flight to land prematurely in Oakland, and the players took cabs to San Francisco, where crowds waited. Winning the title seemed only to make Muley more quirky. A great admirer of the human hand, he hung artwork of fingers and palms throughout his office, and took meetings seated on a chair carved in the shape of an open palm. The room was also adorned with hanging Italian meats, pictures of celebrities from Rudolph Valentino to Albert Einstein, and a plaque from the wives of Warriors players, which read, "Your Italian temperament is surpassed by your kindness." More than one former colleague also recalls Muley firing up a doobie in his office. "There are characters in sports today, but not the same as Franklin," recalls Andy Dulch, a former Warriors, A's, and 49 executive. "We'd be in meetings with the Oakland mayor or the city council or the Coliseum board, and Franklin was several miles away in many of the conversations." Not all of Muley's ideas were winners. Warriors employees even kept a file labeled Franklin's Follies. Foretelling the era of luxury suites, he attempted to give the Warriors' most posh fans a premium experience by converting the first three rows of the Oakland Coliseum into tables adorned with china and tablecloths. The players weren't fans. He also once rode his Honda motorcycle onto the polished floor of the arena and wiped out. Ironically, given the three-pointer's role in the Warriors' future success, Muley was adamantly opposed to the shot, filibustering it at league's meetings about how it was an irredeemable gimmick. "I'm not going to deny I made a lot of mistakes," Muley once said, "but maybe someday I'll pick up a newspaper and see what a genius I am." Meanwhile, he continued his habit of mysterious disappearances. Pete Rozelle, the former NFL commissioner, was friends with Muley. At least he thought he was. Rozelle told Sports Illustrated, "He's always been a floater. I'd see Franklin somewhere in LA, and we'd go out to dinner. And he'd end up staying the night, and then he'd be gone. He'd leave his socks, and I would get them laundered and mail them back to him in an envelope. He still floats. You're in a group with him, and all of a sudden, he disappears." By the late 70s, the Warriors were a sub-500 team, and worse, were again struggling to draw fans. Muley was reluctant to raise ticket prices for fear of reducing demand. He stuck with Addles until after the 1982-83 season because, well, he liked the guy. He would become seduced by players like Joe Barry Carroll, drafting them despite others' misgivings. L. Davis once told Muley, "The trouble with you is you got a love club over there. Everybody loves everybody." Finally, in the spring of 1986, Muley had had enough. The team was losing games and money in equal measure. The Coliseum wasn't the answer to the franchise's venue challenges, so Muley announced his exit plan. That May, former Milwaukee Bucks owner Jim Fitzgerald and his business partner Dan Finane purchased a controlling interest in the Warriors for around $14 million, far less than the $32.5 million owners of the Miami Heat and Charlotte Hornets would pay as an expansion fee the following season. With that, Muley's 24-year tenure as an NBA owner was over. After the sale, he would still attend Warriors games, no hard feelings. When Muley went MIA, sometimes his seat would be filled only by a hat placed there by a fan. He would also show up for 49ers games, and his TV and radio production company lived on. Fitzgerald and Finane owned the team for 8 largely hapless seasons before selling to Chris Cohen for $140 million in 1994. Cohen owned the team for 15 largely hapless seasons before selling to a consortium led by Legub and Peter Guber. By then, the Warriors, still confined to the Oakland Coliseum, fetched $450 million. In the 15 years since, the franchise's venue has increased 20-fold, owing largely to two of Muley's organizing principles, upgraded media rights and an upgraded venue. Franklin Muley died in 2010 at the age of 89, 5 years before the Warriors won their first NBA title in 40 seasons, and 9 years before the franchise's sleek San Francisco home, the Chase Center, would be christened. As the W's have become one of the world's preeminent sports properties, fans of certain age know that a great debt of gratitude is owed a 5'9 man with an iffy jumper who never did shake his propensity for deerstalkers and impetuousness. In the first line of a tribute, Bruce Jenkins, a dean of Bay Area sports media, wrote in 2018, "Franklin Muley was delightful company and a noted eccentric, unfamiliar with formal attire, and known to occasionally appear in disguise. But then, though Muley's sports foresight and the climate he helped create was there plain as a cloudless San Francisco day, out in the open for all to see and enjoy." The final article I'll be reading for this program is "Good as It Gets." After the Aces won their first WNBA title in 2022, Finals MVP Chelsea Gray steered the conversation toward teammate Asia Wilson, who had led all players in the series in scoring and tied for the lead in rebounds. Gray said that Wilson, then only 26, was absolutely in the women's hoops GOAT conversation. "It should already be starting to be talked about. 3 years later, the conversation is already over." In October, Wilson led Las Vegas to a third title in 4 seasons, picking up her second Finals MVP in a sweep of the Mercury. This after leading the league in scoring and winning a record 4th league MVP and a 3rd Defensive Player of the Year award. If the WNBA is in its golden era, and it definitely is, Wilson's greatness is undisputed across all generations. You have your Mount Rushmore, she's alone on Everest, Aces coach Becky Hammon said. There's no one around. We are at the conclusion of this week's Sports Illustrated program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Ben. Thank you for listening. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.